From GPB News, this is On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headley. How often do you work out?
Take a picture of your arm.
You want to take a picture of my arm? Why do you want to take a picture of my arm?
Because it's the skinniest thing I've ever seen in my life. Bro, you got to start lifting, man.
Today we'll talk about why Augusta has been named one of the unhealthiest cities in the nation. First, though, we talked last week about the wage gap between men and women. A recent study finds that gap is larger in the South than anywhere else, and closing it would cut poverty for working women here by more than half. We asked Chandra Childers about this. She's a postdoctoral fellow at the Institute for Women's Policy Research.
The occupations that men and women hold, you know, you talk about leading down to the cause, that is actually a big part of the gender wage gap. It's not all, it does not explain all of the gender wage gap, but it is a big part of the differences in earnings between men and women.
Here are your first thoughts. Heidi in Macon says in her experience, roles in the workplace are not equal between men and women.
I found that regardless of my education and my background and experience, in every job I've had, I've always defaulted to that of secretary or administrative assistant. People just think it's okay to give me their money and ask me to order lunch or to fill up their coffee for them. So, no, women are not equal in the workplace. Thank you.
And thank you, Heidi. Listener Chris Kent emailed us also. He says, quote, I work in a female-dominated environment. Our jobs are threatened by our employer if we discuss pay. But of those who do discuss it, women are hands down paid more per hour than males doing exactly the same job. I believe this is just grandstanding by a liberal female agenda and further persecution of white males. To say a woman is penalized or makes less when they choose not to work as much or when they have children is simply absurd. End quote. We always want to know what you think. You can call us like Heidi did at 404-500-9457. You can also tweet us. We're at OST Talk or email us like Chris did. We might feature your comments on the show. Personal finance site WalletHub conducted a recent study rating the healthiest and unhealthiest cities in America. And it says Augusta is among the least healthy places to live. The study looked at categories like the cost of a doctor visit, fruit and vegetable consumption, and fitness clubs per capita. So with me to talk about it is Rodney Lynn, director of the Division of Health Management and Policy at Georgia State University. Welcome back, Rodney.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be with you.
And you as well. Also with us from Augusta is Kelsey Budge, a personal trainer in the area. Hi, Kelsey.
Hi. Good morning.
It's good to have you. So, Rodney, let's talk about what they used to come up with these titles, right? They talked about the cost of your medical visit, the premature death rate, mental health counselors. Do you think these are relatively good measures of whether a city's healthy?
Well, there were four categories they looked at: healthcare, food, fitness, and green space. And within those are a range of things, and you mentioned some of them: fruit and vegetable behavior, physical activity behavior, cost of a doctor's visit. But they also looked at, premature death. Are people dying prematurely, which is before the age of 75? And so the death of a young person will, you know, hurt your score more than the death of someone at 70, let's say.
Right. So
these are good measures or good things to look at. But I think they're also missing some important measures. There wasn't anything that really looked at tobacco behavior, smoking cigarettes. This is the leading cause of death in the country. If you really look at the actual causes of heart disease and other chronic diseases, tobacco is a major driver of that. So, you know, ideally we'd want to look at both smoking behavior, you know, what percentage of people, adults in that community are smoking, as well as smoke-free air laws. How good are their smoke-free air laws? So that's one thing that's missing. The other thing I'd mention about Augusta is that, you know, depending on the study you look at, you know, their rating will change. So, you know, I, in preparation, looked at the livability index, which the AARP has developed, and they have other categories they look at, including cost of housing, transportation. I mentioned the environment, clean air, clean water. So those are things that really matter for health and well-being as well that were not included here. And if you look at the livability index for Augusta, Georgia, they do a lot better than they did here.
So, Kelsey, what do you think about this? You live and work in Augusta, and you specifically work in fitness. So did you feel like this rating was fair?
To be honest, yes, I do believe it was fair. Just based on the green space that we have that allows people to go walking or hiking or biking, and then the fitness centers as well, I feel are lacking a little bit. I do believe it's quite fair.
So what do you see? And when you are working as a personal trainer, one of the things that they measured was the number of fitness clubs, and presumably that pertains to the number of people that actually go to the gym. What do you see on a daily basis?
A lot of my clients also have gym memberships. I do it on the side at like parks. And a lot of them do not use their membership, even though it's because it's like $10 a month. So it is very affordable, but it doesn't motivate them to go to the gym. And a lot of them are women and they're intimidated by the gyms.
So, Rodney, we got this tweet from someone named John Alvey who says, Augusta, an unhealthy city? Yep, but where in Georgia isn't it easier to find cheap, bad food versus expensive, healthy? $3 burger or $12 salad? This is a problem we have not, and you're in health management, so this is a problem we have not fixed yet.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that this is highlighting is the importance of both environments and behaviors. We encourage people to make healthy choices. We say people should have personal responsibility. But at the same time, if you're not in an environment that, you know, really promotes and supports a healthy choice, it becomes very difficult. So, you know, what Kelsey's talking about in terms of physical activity, behavior is important. But do you have, if you wanted to go for a walk in your community, do you have sidewalks and a safe place to go for a walk or go for a run? If you want to eat healthy and you live in an urban area in, let's say, the city of Atlanta or in Southwest Atlanta, can you access healthy foods? So those are things that really matter. So we've got to not just think about the behavior, but are we creating environments that actually support healthy behaviors?
And Kelsey, this is something that Augusta did not score well on, is the access to healthy food. How do you see that on the streets of Augusta? Do you find that it's easy to go to a place that has fresh fruits and vegetables?
They only offer one farmer's market, and it's closed during the winter. And unfortunately, Whole Foods just closed down. So that was a major hit for the healthy food industry here. The only restaurants that you can go to that are healthy are really downtown, and there's only a handful of them. Everything else that line the streets are fast food restaurants.
If you're just joining me, I'm speaking with Kelsey Budge, a personal trainer in Augusta, and also Rodney Lynn, director of the Division of Health Management and Policy at Georgia State University. So, Kelsey, what would you like to see change in Augusta? What do you think would make it easier for you, not only in your own lifestyle, but for helping your clients?
A lot of the problems with my clients and healthy eating habits are their families, the older members of their families. And so we really need to change just everyone's outlook and behaviors towards food. A lot of people, of course, go for the convenience instead of the healthy options that might take a little bit longer to prepare. So it really is just a huge behavior change, and we need our politicians and the community to really step up and promote healthy foods and healthy lifestyles.
Rodney, why isn't it easier to eat healthy? I mean, when I think back to my grandmother's day, it was much harder for her to get dinner on the table. It would take her longer.
Yeah.
So now that we have all these advancements in technology and efficiency, why isn't it easier for me than it was for my grandmother?
Yeah, the reality is that there's been some changes in the food environment. And, you know, if we look back over the last 30 years, we've seen a proliferation of fast food. We've seen fewer meals being prepared at home. We're busier. We have more adults in the household working. And so as a result, we are eating out more. And the choices that we have are not as healthy as we might like. And so there's, you know, research that, you know, really is looking at the proportion of your energy intake that is occurring outside of the household. That's increased almost threefold. So, you know, if we're going to be eating away from home, then we've got to really think about putting pressure on the food industry to make sure that we have healthy choices. Can I get a salad, or am I just stuck with the burger and fries? And then when I'm eating the burger and fries, is it supersized? Is the soda now 60 ounces instead of 12 ounces? These are realities in the marketplace that we're sometimes not aware of. And so there have been efforts to educate consumers by adding calorie information to the menu board and things like that. But at the end of the day, choice is what's important, is making sure that we're giving people healthy options wherever they're eating. And that's not always the case.
So, Kelsey, is it difficult? I mean, in Augusta, do you have to join the gym to have a healthy fitness regime? Because in many cities, you don't. If I live in New York, I'm going to be walking enough, most likely, where I'm going to get a pretty good workout just for my day-to-day life. Is that the case in Augusta?
No, I don't believe so. Everything is pretty close quarters here. So even if you're walking, it's only maybe a quarter mile at most. But the areas surrounding Augusta have a lot more to offer park-wise and with their athletic leagues.
You mean like outside the city limits?
Correct, yeah. And the study only analyzed the city limits.
Right.
So I think if it's easy to take a 15-minute drive and go to the Savannah Rapids Park and bike there. But in the city of Augusta proper, I definitely don't believe that we have enough
There's not enough
access.
Just day-to-day. And Rodney, let me put that to you too, because this has to be part of your consideration when you're thinking about health management is do you have to, does a population have to join a gym to be healthy, or is there a way to restructure cities so that we're more active than we are now?
Yeah, my hope is that everyone doesn't have to be a gym member. I'm just coming back last week from the Active Living Research Conference, which is a national meeting that really brings together not just public health folks, but people that work in transportation and planning, parks and recreation. And so really thinking about just what you're saying, how do we structure and develop communities such that people active lifestyle is an easy choice? And so we talk about things like, you know, where is transit located? Is it in close proximity to communities? Because people that use transit are more physically active, as you just pointed out. There's research on that. Complete streets. When we develop new roadways, are we creating opportunities for biking? You know,
a bike lane and a sidewalk. For the love of Pete,
correct.
Georgia, build sidewalks.
Yeah. So the environment does really matter. And you know, developers, when they come to a city or a county and say, "I want to put in this new community," it's up to that city or community to say, "Yes, but we're mandating sidewalks and green space for our residents and bike lanes, whatever it may be, so that you're having an environment that really promotes health rather than impedes health."
I've been speaking with Rodney Lynn. He's a director of the Division of Health Management and Policy at Georgia State University. We've been looking at a recent study from Wallet Hub that suggests Augusta is one of the least healthy cities in the country. We also spoke with Kelsey Budge, a personal trainer in Augusta. Kelsey and Rodney, thank you both so much.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you very much.
Just ahead, mosques in Georgia open their doors to change minds about Muslims. First, though, Pulitzer Prize-nominated journalist Robert Corum joins us to talk about his very honest memoir on growing up in the South. This is on Second Thought. It's on Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. Pulitzer Prize-nominated journalist Robert Corum is used to writing about other people's lives. He's written a number of biographies. But his new book focuses on his own life. It's called Gully Dirt, on exposing the Klan, raising a hog, and escaping the South. And Robert Corum joins me in our studio. Welcome back.
Good morning.
So, I mean, I have to ask first what gully dirt is.
Gully dirt is the sorriest dirt on earth. It's what's left when the topsoil and the substrate wash away. It's dirt that is good for absolutely nothing.
And why is that the title of your memoir?
My father frequently told me that I was sorry as gully dirt, and I thought that would make a good title.
So this, you are a much braver person than I. I mean, I have to say, this memoir is just ruthlessly honest. You reveal things I don't think I've ever read in a memoir before in my life. How difficult was that?
I think anyone who writes a memoir winds up in need of a therapist. And my goal was to dig deeply and to be honest. And I think I was too honest and perhaps dug too deeply. And I paid a price for it.
What do you mean?
I excavated some things that might have better been left buried. And I've been supporting the mental health industry for a couple of years because of this book.
I have to assume that one of the things you're talking about in terms of excavation is the relationship with your father.
Yes.
Who was a veteran from the Army and by all accounts, a fairly brutal man.
That he was.
Some of the scenes in there with your father are really tough. They were tough to read, so I have to imagine they were difficult, even after all these years, to write. How have you grappled with that, and why are you just coming to write about it this much further on?
I've been working on the book off and on for about 30 years, a sentence here and a paragraph there and a scene here. And about 10 years ago, I guess, started putting it all together and dividing it up into chapters. And about 5 years ago, I finished another biography, and I said, it's time to do the memoir. I've been working on it, playing with it for long enough, so I spent about a year and a half writing it.
So another thing, I mean, just to go back to with your father, one of the things that you describe are some public beatings that you got at your father's hand. And it's brought home very painfully the difference between a beating you sustain at home versus one in the light of day with everyone watching. Why do you think he did that? Have you had any further understanding on him and his motivation?
He spent 30 years in the Army and was used to punishing recruits, I suppose, and there were always other people around. So the night I got baptized in the Baptist church, as I was going down into the baptismal pool, I said, "Good gosh, this water's cold," something like that. And he pulled me out of line after church, and as other people were streaming out of the church, he was beating me with a belt right there at the foot of the steps.
What do you think that did to you? Do you even remember what you were thinking at the time?
It was a little humiliating, embarrassing. And my dad wouldn't let me cry when he beat me like that. I had to just plant my feet and stand there. And today I find that I cry a lot. I cry reading roadmaps. And I ask my therapist about it, and he said because I was not allowed to cry as a child, that I have a lot of tears backed up. So the wounds were deep, and they're writing the memoir enabled me to learn about myself in ways I never had before, and to know things about myself that I just had never connected the dots before.
So I wonder how much your feelings over your father were wrapped up in your feelings with the South. Could you have separated your memories of growing up in a very small town in rural Georgia from your relationship with your dad?
He was from Southwest Georgia, and after he retired, we lived up in around Pine Mountain for maybe a couple of years and then went back to deep Southwest Georgia. So his family settled that part of Georgia in the 1840s, and the family's been there for many, many generations. And I'm part of that, whether I like it or not.
Well, let's talk about whether you like it or not. And I have to say, as I was reading this book, I was reminded of a line from a Faulkner novel when someone asks one of his characters, why do you hate the South? And his answer is, I don't hate it. I don't hate it. I don't hate it. And when I was reading your memoir, I kept thinking about that. Yeah. Do you hate Edison?
Well, first, thanks for the comparison to Faulkner. I like that part. I have mixed feelings about Edison. I'm from there, but my earliest memories of Edison are wanting to get out. I was one of only two boys in the class. It was a class of 22, 12 boys and 10 girls. And I was one of only two boys that did not come from a farming family. So I was separate from everybody. I couldn't rebuild a transmission on a tractor. I didn't like to go bird hunting. It really bothered me to kill birds. I didn't like talking about the Civil War as if we were in a lull between battles. I was not an ancestor worshiper. There was nothing that everyone else talked about that was even on my radar screen. So I was an outlier from the beginning, and I just wanted out. I thought it was some cosmic joke that some spaceship was flying between New Orleans, New York, and L.A., and they just, this cosmic whim threw me out over deep southwest Georgia because I never belonged there.
So, one of the really great, the whole book is written so vividly, it's quite easy to picture. But one of the great early stories you tell is your trip to Valley Forge with the Boy Scouts. And it struck me, your description of all these boys on traveling up there, and they all brought their Confederate flags. That was your first trip out of Edison, right?
It was. And there were a group I was got on in Albany. It had come to Atlanta and from there to Washington. And in Albany, everybody who got on was wearing one of those little Confederate hats and waving a battle flag or had it on their backpack. In Atlanta, everyone from Georgia gathered together, and the whole train was full of people doing rebel yells. And we were going to a place where our country was formed and making the battle cries of someone, those who tried to break the country apart.
I mean, this book deals with your young life. This isn't all of Robert Corum's life. This is the beginning of it, and we start to see through it your very earliest thoughts about race. How did you? I mean, judging from what you're describing growing up, I wonder how you came to not be racist.
Well, I was early on. I grew up in a very racist time and surrounded by racists, and that was what I was taught. There's a line in South Pacific that says you've got to be carefully taught, and I was. And it was a book by Frank Yerby, I think, that started turning my thinking around. I thought he was – I discovered him when I was about 14, and I thought he was the greatest storyteller I'd ever come across in my life. And I read his book. Book after book after book, and finally I found one. There was a dust jacket on it, and I turned it over, and he was black, and I just couldn't gather that, given the way that I had grown up, and that a black man had written the greatest book I had ever read, and he was a bestseller. His first book became a movie, and oddly enough, he left about the time I graduated from high school. He left Georgia and went to Spain. He said he could no longer stand the racism in his home state. So that was the beginning. But
you said that you still keep his book by your bedside. Which one is it?
The Foxes of Hara. I read it every year.
If anyone has not checked out the books of Frank Yerby, he wrote a number of them, A Woman Called Fancy, Judish My Brother, and Born in Augusta, Georgia, great, great books. If you're just joining us, I am speaking with Robert Corum. His new memoir is called Gully Dirt, on exposing the Klan, raising a hog, and escaping the South. But the Klan is a character in your young life and in the book. How did people talk about it, or did they?
They didn't. We were very much aware of the Klan and some of the things that they were alleged to have done. And one day, some friends of mine and I going down a road that was being paved, and there was a Klan house there, and we found their robes. And in the top of each hat was the name of the owner, and it was some of the most prominent people in the county, school teachers, professional people, farmers. I knew every name I ran across in there. And I kept digging deeper in this big chest where all the robes were, looking for a robe with my dad's name on it, because somehow I sensed that he had a robe in there. And I never found it, and I never knew for sure that he was a member, but I believe that he was.
You know, many of the things that you describe in your book are just, as I've mentioned, incredibly honest. You talk about your early sexual experiences with really, in some ways, amusing. I mean, you clearly have a sense of humor about it. But brutal honesty in many ways. Why? Why include that? How does that help your book?
I thought the story was so bleak that there had to be some humor in it. Were there not, it would be like Schindler's List without the happy ending. And a lot of the things that happen to kids are humorous when you get a little distance and look back on them. And the humor was an important part of the book. And the I'm not sure I would call them, well, sexual scenes, but it's more romance, because I had a very, I'm an incurable romantic and have been from the very early days. And I think that those scenes are described in a romantic, loving moonbeam and pixie dust sort of light. And I think that the women, if they're still alive, who read that, would be like it, that their first boyfriend remembered them in such a nice way. I like
and in such detail.
Yeah. Well, okay.
What, you have a very little patience in this book for the romantic ideas of the South, the misty sort of Vaseline-smeared lens that many people often talk about. You call it claptrap. Did you have that as a kid? And when, if so, when did it disappear?
I think there are many South. There's the Old South, the New South, the Romantic South, the Faulkner South, the Moonbeam and Magnolia South. But I came from the hard South. It's a brutal South, a racist South, where the Klan was there. And the people are very narrow, and they are, it was like living in a medieval city. People rarely went out of the city limits. It was a big deal to go up to Columbus, over to Albany, which was 40 miles away. And it was a restrictive, confining, narrow, judgmental town. And most people love their hometowns, and I have a hard time with that, because I never fit in, and all I ever wanted to do was get out. And perhaps I'm a traitor to my roots. I don't know, but that's, I was from the South, but not of the South.
And yet one of the things you point out is that Edison was not anti-Semitic, which made it different, unique among the other rural towns. Why was Edison free of that particular kind of bigotry?
The most prominent family in town was a Jewish family, and Mr. Bill Israel, who owned the local department store, while I was in high school, was voted not the man of the day or the man of the week or the man of the month. He was voted the man of the century. A Jewish guy in Southwest Georgia voted the man of the century, and he was the pillar of Edison. Everybody loved him. So I didn't know until I left Edison that there were people who were anti-Semitic. I'd never heard of that. I couldn't imagine it.
You end quite, as I mentioned, quite early in your life. Are there more memoirs coming? Is this a part one?
That was the painful one, and it was very difficult. Yes, there is another one. I'm 200 pages into it, and it I'm really having a lot of fun writing this one. It's not as bleak as the first one.
So you have written four biographies, a number of biographies of other people.
Yes, yeah.
Did it help you or hurt you that you were already pretty able at talking about other people's lives?
It was a help. I wrote seven novels that were easily forgettable, and but I learned to write in writing those novels, so they served some benefit. And I did a couple of biographies with other people, collaborations, and it was an easy segue from that into biographies. And my biographies read like novels, and it's been a an evolution. So, yeah.
But were you tempted to leave things out to clean up some of the obvious heartbreak of your childhood?
No, I think if you're going to write a memoir, that number one, you have to be honest, absolutely brutally honest, and you can't think of the consequences of what you're, or the fallout of what you're writing. You just, as I said, you have to dig deep and be absolutely honest. And I never thought about any fallout. It's happening now, but I had never thought of it.
What do you mean it's happening now?
Well, they're not going to be holding any parades for me in Edison. And people are saying, how could you treat your hometown that way? And what will people in other parts of the country think? And I want to say, do you think people in New York or Omaha or Chicago, if somebody writes something critical, do they say, oh, my, what are those people in the South going to think of us? No, they don't. They don't care. So why should we care? But we do. The South has a great inferiority complex regarding the rest of the country. And I think they're afraid that some of the stereotypes about the South might be true.
We only have about 30 seconds left, but the fact of the matter is that you escaped the South and then came back.
Well, in many ways, Atlanta is not the South. Atlanta's the new South, and outside the perimeter is still the old South. And I don't consider Atlanta, except in the very broadest sense, to be part of the South.
That is journalist Robert Corum. His memoir is called Gully Dirt on Exposing the Klan, Raising a Hog, and Escaping the South. It is a good read. Robert Corum, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Just ahead, we visit a mosque in Atlanta that has opened its doors to people of all faiths and meet an author who writes about the beauty and brutality of the Appalachians. This is On Second Thought. This is On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. Tomorrow, we talk about Georgia's wildlife, from the bushy-tailed variety that climb our trees to the ancient shelled types that swim off our shores. We want to hear about your experiences with Georgia's furry or scaly critters. You can call us at 404-500-9457, tweet us at OST Talk, or email us, and we might feature your comment on the show. When we think of Southern Gothic, a lot of names come to mind: Flannery O'Connor, William Faulkner, Cormac McCarthy. Critics include North Carolina-based author David Joy in that category as well. His new novel, The Weight of This World, takes us into a gritty, seamy world in rural Appalachia. Characters are tormented by their own demons, sometimes by the past. David Joy's in Atlanta tonight for a book talk. Thank you so much for being with us, David.
No, thank you for having me.
So I understand that the first book tour was pretty exhausting for you on a number of levels. Is the second one any better?
I'd like to think that I'm getting better at it, but the reality is I have pretty bad anxiety normally anyways, and I live in a place where I live in a very rural section of Appalachia. I don't interact with very many people on a daily basis. I don't travel. And so outside of book tours, you know, I don't really travel around. And so, you know, that first book tour was really exhausting. It was 19 cities in 21 days, and then the paperback was another dozen cities, and so, you know, I wind up coming home just incredibly exhausted, and so I'd like to think that I'm getting better at it, but the reality is, you know, I'm still living in a constant anxiety attack.
No. So, I mean, the way you've described your writing environment to me feels really a huge contrast with the subject matter you're writing about. So you're writing about, both in this one and your first novel, they're very gritty. I mean, there's murder, there's violence, there's talk about anxiety. There's this balance between the literature, the literary value, and then the just a raw, gritty action that's going on. And yet I read that you need like perfect peace and silence in order to write. How do you achieve that?
I think that balance of kind of poetry mixed with brutality, I think that's something, you know, I learned from writers like William Gay. You know, a short story like The Paper Hanger, at the end of that story, you know, there's a child that's murdered, and I can remember the language of his description right this second. It's some of the most beautiful language I've ever read, and so that juxtaposition of brutality versus really poetic language, I think that's coming from, you know, writers like William Gay and writers like Ron Rash, Larry Brown, Daniel Woodrell. As far as needing perfect peace and quiet, I'm finishing a novel right now, and when I have to do ordinary things, like when I have to go to Walmart because I have to buy groceries, or if I have to go cook myself lunch, it feels like I'm living in a dream world. And I guess that's because it's so involved to get into a story that it's really hard to separate yourself, and so really I think that's why, you know, I need the space and I need the peace and quiet, because otherwise I wouldn't be able to to kind of live inside of that narrative.
So when you say Southern Gothic, one of the first names that comes to mind is Flannery O'Connor. And probably the best known work of hers is A Good Man is Hard to Find. That's a short story she wrote about a family trip. So here's a little snippet of Flannery O'Connor reading part of that story in 1957.
She saw the man's face twisted close to her own, as if he were going to cry, and she murmured, "Why, you're one of my babies. You're one of my own children." She reached out and touched him on the shoulder. The misfit sprang back as if a snake had bitten him and shot her three times through the chest.
So you have made the distinction between Southern Gothic, like Flannery O'Connor wrote, and what you call Appalachian noir. What is the difference?
When I think of Gothic, to be quite honest with you, I more think of people like Edgar Allan Poe than I do people like Flannery O'Connor. You know, people always use that term, the Southern Gothic. And for me, I don't know if I'm kind of have an aversion to that term or what it is. You know, for me, I like the terms grit lit. I like the terms the Rough South. You know, people always talked about Larry Brown's Rough South. And ultimately, I think they're all kind of talking about the same thing, and that's definitely the lineage and tradition that I'm coming out of. You know, I think starting with Faulkner and then carrying on later into O'Connor and Cormac McCarthy, you know, writing in the '60s, and then in the '80s we get Larry Brown, we get William Gay, we get Harry Cruse, and then on into Barry Hannah, and you know, that's the same tradition that's being continued today. And kind of led by a writer like Ron Rash, but that's kind of the lineage that I'm in. Whatever you want to term it, I think the style stylistically, I think it's very similar.
So then let's hear from another voice that we associate with this genre, and that's William Faulkner. And this is Faulkner himself in the late 50s, and he's talking to an English class at the University of Virginia.
Man is faced, frail, fragile, flesh and bone, mostly water, in a ramshackle universe stuck together with electricity, faced with problems which are usually bigger than he is. Does he face it? Does it lick him? That, I think, is what anyone writes about.
That comment of Faulkner's actually really reminds me of both your novels. You are, you make no excuses for your characters, who are quite flawed and in many ways very fragile. Where does this attraction to the sort of, not an anti-hero, but a sort of struggling human being, someone who is very much a work in progress, why do you like to write about that kind of person?
I think I'm really interested in trying to get to the humanity of a character. You know, Larry Brown said one time, he said, of his own work, he said, "It's all right for you to call it brutal, but just admit by God that it's honest." And I think, you know, for me, it's that same type of thing. I was kind of thinking about, you know, right before a book tour and right before a book comes out, you wind up having to write all of these essays for different people and different things. And so I've spent a lot of time lately really trying to think about, you know, why I write the types of things I write. And one of the things is, I think I'm interested in going to the darkest places imaginable and trying to find some aspect of humanity, because if I couldn't, I would lose hope in the world. I think in a lot of ways, and that may be a selfish reason, but I do think in a lot of ways that's what I'm trying to do as an artist. You know, if I can go to the darkest places imaginable and I can find something that I can connect with, then all of a sudden that opens an entire world up to conversation. And so, you know, really, if readers don't take anything else away from my work, that's what I would want them to take away.
Well, I mean, we're talking in very high terms about literature, but these are just really good reads. I mean, they just keep you in your seat. On the other hand, there are these deeper themes going on, and this new book is so much centered around trauma and sort of the way our past affects our present life, and the balance between making new choices as opposed to the choices that have already been made in many ways.
Yeah.
What is it in Appalachia itself, what is it, do you think, that people don't understand about the people who live there and the area?
Well, I think outside of the region, people want to believe a very specific thing, and I think that's because it makes it easier.
You mean the stereotype of poor, uneducated?
Yeah, and ultimately, I think that's just easier. If we can say, well, all of these people are just like this, and within the past year, with a book like J.D. Vance's Hillbilly Elegy, I think in a lot of ways they were trying to create a broad voting block. They were trying to say, well, they're all like this, and that's why this happened. Just because that's easier. The reality is that
you mean this happened. You're referring to the election of Donald Trump.
Yeah, yeah. When the reality is that this place is incredibly complex. When people talk about Appalachia, one of the things is they're only talking about West Virginia and Kentucky. They're not talking about a region that stretches from Mississippi to Maine. There's not coal where I live. The biggest issue we've been facing forever is unrestricted land development. They're God-fearing people and the godless. They're people who do what they have to do, working 70 hours a week to survive, and there are people who break in houses. It's not any different than anywhere else in America in that sense. You have incredible diversity here. And so really, I think that's the biggest issue I face when I hit the road, because people always, I've had people say, well, I had somebody say, well, how do they feel about the books where you live? And before I could answer, the woman looked at me and said, or can they read? And my response was, of course they can read. And we have shoes too, And so I think people that come out of this place, we're defensive, but it's also because we have to be defensive, because the picture that's typically painted of the entire region is inaccurate.
So you don't create outlines of your books, which really surprises me when I'm reading them. They're clearly character driven, and I wonder how often do your characters surprise you by where they take the story?
Yeah, all the time, and so recently, I was finishing a novel that I'm on contract for, and right up to the last day, when you start getting to the end of a book, you can really start to see where you think it's going to go, probably more so than in the beginning or anywhere else. But even then, right up to the end, those characters were surprising me every day, and I was having a conversation with a writer named Julia Franks recently, and for her, she said that she knows the ending first, which was really interesting to me, because that I don't know anything about the ending, and what I told her was that if I did, I don't think I would write the book. I think the part of the excitement and the fun for me is kind of following these characters blindly and just seeing where they take me.
Wait, so no, I'm not gonna. No spoilers, but your first novel, which has a surprise at the end, you didn't know that was coming?
No. I honestly didn't know what happened until Jacob was standing in that room.
Wow.
I truly did not. I knew that I didn't think it would end well.
And it didn't.
but. Until he walked into that house and found what he found, I had no clue that was there. And I can remember reaching a point in that book where, especially at the very end, where I just sat there and I cried because I didn't know where it was going until right then. And when I knew, there was incredible emotion that came with that.
Oh, I can imagine. And that's the most detail we're going to get, because I hope people read the book for themselves. David Joey is author of the new book, The Weight of This World. He'll speak tonight at Acapella Books. His visit is part of the Writers at the Wrecking Bar series, and it starts at 7 o'clock. David, such a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Muslims are a mystery to many Americans, and to some they are targets. In recent weeks, several Atlanta-area mosques have received death threats. Leaders of all faiths across the state hope to give people a better understanding of Islam. So over the weekend, GPB's Olivia Reingold visited an Atlanta mosque that opened its doors for the second annual Visit a Mosque Day.
So here we have the women that are basically say the prayers. We've gone through why it's a difference, I think, with them. If you have questions, just ask me. But
my name is Jeff Sadiq, and I'm one of the board of director members at Al Farouk Masjid of Atlanta. Today we heard at our open house Dr. Khalid Sadiq, and he was trying to give clarification of information from the Quran to more of a layman's terms.
I've been talking a lot. I think by now you should know that I'm a Muslim. Right? Now I want to ask you, what do I believe in?
My name is Khalid Sadiq. I'm the Director of Education and Outreach Programs. The way we tailored this program today was, first of all, to describe the very basic principles of Islamic teaching, and then the areas of misconception about Islam, women, terrorism, Sharia law, etc.
This is my first time in a mosque, and it was my first time wearing hijab. I'm Tiffany Washington, and I'm from Decatur, Georgia. I was aware of the threats that Atlanta mosques have seen in the recent weeks. I think it's really important to show solidarity with our Muslim neighbors, to let them know that we're here, especially kind of in this unjust society right now and what's happening. I really want to be an ally for our Muslim neighbors, so that's why I'm here today.
My name is Desmond Drummer. I'm the administrator at Most Blessed Sacrament Catholic Church in Southwest Fulton. What brought me here today? A parishioner actually alerted me to this and said, I would like for you to know about this. And I said, well, let's share it with the whole church. And we had almost 40 parishioners from our small community here. I greeted some as we trickled in and trickled out, and they were all saying, wow, we have so much in common. And we all had that inkling, but it's different to hear a Muslim in their house of worship share their story.
My name is Yasmeen Taylor, and I live in the city of Atlanta. My 11-year-old experienced an incident just last week in school where one of his classmates was saying some bad things about Islam, and my son said, well, you know, my grandpa who just died was Muslim. And the little boy said, well, if he was Muslim, then he should just stay dead. Yeah, that's devastating. Sorry. That's another reason why I wanted to come out and be supportive.
Allahu Akbar. Samia Allahu liman hamida. Allahu Akbar.
That story was produced by GPB's Olivia Reingold. And that's our show for today, but as always, we want to hear from you. We heard from two very prolific Southern writers, Robert Corum and David Joy, today. So who is your favorite writer from the South? Call us at 404-500-9457 or find us on Facebook or Twitter. For today, that's On Second Thought from GPB News. I'm Celeste Headley. Have a great day.